This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora, assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another episode of Headscarves and Good Yarns. First episode for the year 2026, baby. I hope everyone has had an amazing, amazing end of year holiday season. Regardless of what you got up to, I hope you had the opportunity to just rest. I know there's a lot of expectations around this time of the year, but whatever, however it came about, I hope it was just a time of goodness for everyone. I really want to start this year talking about identity. And I know I've been on one with identity at the moment, but it's just so important. I feel like once you, like just in life in general, not just specifically about the podcast, but so much like comes from really knowing who you are, and so much like power and strength and resilience can come from your identity. And I think this is a great place to start this year, to set us up for another wonderful year of headscarves and good yarns. And you know me, we are going to get political about it, but you know, identity is something that's just so personal. And I think when it comes to any kaupapa, your activism benefits if you can weave it into your personal world, and it's not just something that's information based or theoretical or based on analysis. And don't get me wrong, that is really, really important. But that like sense of solidarity and the commitment and the dedication really, yeah, and that curiosity and that empathy really comes from when you make it personal. And there's nothing more personal than your identity. And so I really wanted to start the year talking about identity politics versus just our human complexity. Because as our queen Roxane Gay put it, you know, they said it, identity is both a lens and a trap. And, you know, I'm not too sure what the forecast for, you know, 2026 is going to look like, but it just seems like everything is happening all at once, you know, with the increase in red pill masculinity and like the masculinity, like Andrew Tate influences, the misinformation cycles that that just take off before like fact checking is happening. Like fact checking just cannot keep up with how fast misinformation moves. You know, climate disasters that feel weekly, the, you know, quote unquote privilege panic where everyone's really scared of getting it wrong, and a high key, that constant just exhaustion of, you know, just being online. And somehow, you know, in the middle of that, we are all just trying to figure out who we are. And I feel like it's hard to show up ethically in a space where it's just like, you know, becoming quite extreme and polarized. And I think what I really want to ask in this question is, you know, how do we center identity without getting trapped in identity performance? You know, like when we're peeling back the tensions and the contradictions, the hope, the harm, the confusion, and, you know, we're really going to get into it. And I think a really good place to start is just talking about the fact that, you know, identity is not like it's a new thing. You know, like identity politics definitely didn't start with like online think pieces or TikTok infographics or Instagram infographics as well. And I think identity, you know, is really important. Like if we think back to the Combahee River Collective, you know, a group of black lesbian feminists said, you know, we need language that explains how systems harm people differently. So when you think about it like that, it's not just a brand, it's not like a curated vibe. It's a language that is low-key like a political diagnostic tool, right? It's a name, it's a way of naming injustice with clarity. But if we kind of think about how our relationship to identity now, it's kind of changed. You know, we've kind of moved from identity as an analysis or a diagnostic tool or a way to understand ourselves in the world more to kind of like identity as an aesthetic. And I feel like the internet really reinforces that. You know, we have, if I think back to my algorithm, we've got the clean girl but make it Muslim, the brown girl self-care era, and yeah, I think it's interesting. There's a sociologist called, I feel like I'm going to pronounce your name incorrectly, but I'll try my best, Zygmunt Bauman, and he kind of predicted the shift. He said that, you know, made the argument that late modern life turns identity into something we assemble and display, not something we inherit organically. So, you know, now identity narratives, they're not just a personal thing, they've become more performative. And so we're not just like living our identities, we're curating them. And if you think about like this shift in how we view identity, how we experience identity, coupled with the polarization that is happening, coupled with just the way we use internet now is quite different. It just seems like it's embedded and enmeshed into our lives. And I think, you know, the internet does not reward complexity. And I, you know, I think the internet hates incompleteness, especially when you think about like identity is something that's always in process and it's never complete. You know, it's not like we reach a spot and it's like, this is it. I've reached saturation point and I'm never going to learn anything, or I'm never going to change my mind about anything. It's a forever thing. It's a forever learning thing. But I think, yeah, that internet does not like that, the forever learning vibes. It likes completion. You know, if you think about it, like TikTok very much rewards certainty. Instagram rewards polish. Twitter, X, you know, rewards the hottest take delivered the fastest. And I feel like we are constantly kind of living in this tension. So, which is tough because identity is fluid, but online identity is treated as a finished product. And the gap between those two things, there is just friction there. And I really want to talk about this, particularly at the beginning of the year, is because I feel like identity, as our world is, you know, the more that is happening, and, you know, regardless of where you lie on the political spectrum, or regardless of, you know, what you think about the world, there are so many things that are happening, and so many movements are happening across the world, and there's all of these natural disasters that are happening. You read the news and so much is going down that, you know, I feel like we need to have a not more than just a chat, but, you know, solutions come from the conversations. But we as a collective, as a world, we need to have a chat about our systems and the impacts that they have and who they harm and who they champion and who they silence and who they favor. And with all of this stuff happening, like the tension is getting bigger and that friction is getting harder to ignore. So regardless of, you know, how you feel or think about the world and what's happening, that friction is, yeah, it's happening more. And it's going to get to a point where we can no longer ignore the heat. And I feel like if we were all more open and knowledgeable about our own identities, we could have, you know, those nuanced, uncomfortable but much needed conversations, and how we feel about our identity is going to become even more important. You know, we're living through overlapping global crises, in every sense, you know, political, economic, environmental, and social. And when stuff like that happens, like, there is an instability that makes people crave clarity. You know, Karen Stinner, who is a political psychologist, says that people don't reject diversity, they reject complexity under threat. But if you think about it, like, none of this is simple. None of this is going to be put into a neat box or a neat label. Like, this, the level of complexity that we need to acknowledge and hold while we're thinking about how to deal with this increasing friction in our world, we need to be able to handle that complexity. And, you know, it is a nuanced, layered thing, but I feel like a huge part of being able to hold that complexity is to be, you know, aware and more confident and to our identity. And the reason why it's so important is because knowing who you are, it informs how you move through this world and the lens in which you see this world. You know, your identity becomes a map, a shield, a tribe, a storyline, a shorthand, a form of emotional security. And so if we're living in a time where we're craving that clarity, and in this time when we're craving clarity, we reject complexity. It's very easy to reject that complexity when your identity is telling you a certain story. If the map that you're referring to has, you know, been the one that you would just, you know, being given as a result of your environment and your lived experience, instead of looking at the map and being like, you know, why, and questioning what is on my map and how is it guiding me and how I move through this world. And, you know, I think you can see that rejection of complexity when you think about the trad wife resurgence, you know, like, because femininity, I feel like I said that word wrong, is simpler than feminism. There's a huge, you know, there's a big anti-woke backlash. And you do see that this sentiment a lot, which is, you know, I miss when things were straightforward. You know, the increasing transphobia. If gender is fluid, what anchors me? there's the racial reckoning fatigue. You know, I'm tired of talking about racism, but scared to stop talking about racism. The increase in anti-immigration sentiments that are happening, the increased, you know, rise of the right. And Ulrich Beck is a sociologist and has the idea of a risk society. So when everything feels risky, identities become safety mechanisms. And it very much fits in with what, you know, Karen Stenner was saying about rejecting complexity under threat. And that threat and friction, it's on our necks at the moment with, you know, everything that's happening. So you can see how identities can become safety mechanisms in that time. And then there's also privilege panic. Thank you, Phoebe Maltzbovi, for the word. You know, where people become terrified of being seen as privileged, so they cling to identity categories to kind of establish that legitimacy. And so I think this is why, you know, talking about identity just feels so intense these days. And so when you think about it, like, people are not fighting about identity, they're fighting for psychological safety. But you can see how identity is used that way. And I think when there is, you know, when identities do become safety mechanisms and people just want that simplicity, you can see how identities can become an easy thing to kind of fall back on to justify the simple way of looking at the world. But nothing about this is simple. It is very complex, very, very complex. But you can see how it's much easier to do that, to use identity as a safety mechanism. And when identities become safety mechanisms, it's really easy for the, you know, systems to socialize our feelings, right? If there's a, you know, valid fear there about the uncertainty of our future, you can see how the system can socialize those feelings. And, you know, all of a sudden we are scared and, you know, blame immigrants for the state of the world right now. Like, I know that I've mentioned this video in an earlier episode, but yeah, I was watching this YouTube video with my husband, and this guy, he's half white, half black, and he went like undercover as a white person when they had that like anti-immigration march in the UK, just to interview people. And I think, you know, the whole point of it was to, like, it was very much giving MAGA vibes, like, make, you know, Britain great again, which aka means, you know, make Britain white again. And everything that people were saying, you could just see how identity had become a safety mechanism, and, you know, their fear and uncertainty had just been, like, socialized into, you know, the worldview that they landed on, to the point where, you know, they came to this rally. And so I think it's really important, when identity is so important to how we navigate through this world, it's really important that it's something that we invest in. And in our online world, I think it's really important, even more so, because the internet loves binaries, but us humans, we don't fit into them. You know, complexity doesn't go viral, simplicity does. You know, communication theorist Marshall McLuhan argues that the medium shapes the message. And so these days online, the mediums reward certainty, outrage, clarity, sides, simplified morality. And so, you know, all of a sudden nuance becomes something that is suspicious. You know, even to say something like this is complicated, you know, then the accusations of like being apolitical or neutral or, you know, centering yourself swiftly follows. And, you know, I think a really good reminder here from Amina Mama is that liberation requires complexity, not performance. And I do, as I'm saying this, I do want to put this caveat out there. And I, as I said in the episode before, like, of course, it's kind of like a line to this. Like, there are some things that aren't that complicated, but, you know, our system likes to tell us that it is. But I'm talking about things that are in that, you know, quote unquote gray zone. And I think when simplicity is encouraged, is almost impossible to, almost impossible to really question things. Like, even if, you know, I've started thinking a certain way about something, and I haven't changed my mind about this particular thing, or there's a particular part of my, a particular aspect of my identity, and I've decided that I haven't changed how I think about this. Every single time where I've like welcomed that complexity, it's given me a different angle to think about things. It's given me a lot more empathy and awareness. Like, there's always an education there when you embrace that complexity. And I think something that just a quick example that kind of shows how complexity isn't encouraged but simplicity is viral. When Beyonce dropped Cowboy Carter, the fights online were insane about, you know, whether it was black enough or country enough or political enough or subversive enough. And I think the nuance with Cowboy Carter was that she was expanding the genre, but that nuance was not captured. It did not travel as fast as the binaries do, which is, you know, is this black, is this country music, is this political, or is this subversive? But I truly do think the whole point of Cowboy Carter was just to expand the genre. Like, there's so many different ways that country music can look and sound, and same with the black music as well. And I think another thing that the internet has, the impacts of the internet, is that its identity has kind of changed to something that you don't just have, but it's something that you broadcast. So, like, identity in itself has kind of become its own content genre, you know, its own aesthetic. And, like, the idea of this, I really like how cultural theorist Hannah McCann described this, and calls it identity curation. So it's like managing your identity like a portfolio. And you have, like, you know, identities like the POC, feminist hot takes, sad, ethnic girl core, diaspora humor. this is coming from my algorithm, by the way. It very much speaks to what I'm doing on TikTok. And, you know, of course, these identities can be like digital home places, but then, you know, because of the internet and the internet liking that simplicity, they can also become, you know, predictable narrative products. Like, if you are Muslim, then people will expect hijab tutorials and political commentary and Ramadan vlogs. You know, and at that point, that identity becomes a brand rather, you know, rather than just like, this is, you know, this person, this is part of their identity. So, of course, they you know, might talk about these things, but there's so much more to them. And I feel like sometimes that pressure can be suffocating. And I think another good example of this is like the red pill masculinity that's kind of on the up, unfortunately, these days. You know, someone did some research on masculinity and called this moment masculinities in crisis. So, you know, Michael Kimmel's research found that these days, masculinity online is hypercoded, it's aesthetic, and it's algorithmically amplified. You know, we've got terms like Riz masculinity, disciplined king energy, Sigma grind set 2.0, husband school, biohacking for men, soft red pill rebrands. And so these are, you know, all of those things are identity scripts that it's easy to adopt under pressure. And, you know, there's a lot of pressure in our world. You know, that friction I was talking about, you know, we all feeling it. And that complexity kind of gets rejected. And then you have the internet who, and they offer that certainty. It's like, look at this ready-made identity. And I know that you fit into the story because I know how you feel. You see what I mean by like, systems being able to socialize our, you know, like valid human emotions, and it provides this way out of confusion. And, you know, we've also got that tension between like the left and right. And I feel like personally, identity discourse on both ends is hella exhausted. Because on one side you have perfection politics and constant corrections and ideological audits and like, you know, if you don't know this framework or, you know, are you even conscious? Like, are you even woke? And then on the other hand, you have like men are under attack and everything woke is bad and just dehumanizing the heck out of marginalized groups and like prompting like culture wars. And both extremes use identity as a weapon, not a bridge to like try to cross this sea of complexity that we need to wade through. It's absolutely being used as a weapon. And you know what really speeds up that weapon? Misinformation. You know, I feel like these days misinformation is personalized. You know, Joan Donovan, a media scholar, calls this identity-driven misinformation. And the way that I, like, what identity-driven misinformation relies on, it relies on pre-existing stereotypes, racial fears, cultural anxieties, polarized scripts. So, you know, identity becomes the hook. And you see what I'm trying to say about, you know, our emotions being socialized. Identity-driven misinformation, you know, identity becomes the emotional entry point. And you can see how the stereotypes and the fears and the anxieties, identity can kind of come in, swoop on that and be like, well, here's some clarity. Here's the simplicity to reduce that friction. But it's actually not reducing that friction in any way, shape, or form. And then also another thing that I have noticed on... Well, this... Yes, definitely seeing this happen in real life, but particularly online, we've kind of entered this like oppression Olympics as well. And I think if we were more comfortable with our identities, then we would be more comfortable with embracing the intersectionality of it all, right? And understanding that our intersectionality is like a lens in which to view this world. But because the internet has completely, you know, steamrolled the complexity out of everything, you know, identity has also become a weird ranking system of oppression Olympics. You know, online identity often, you know, has now kind of become a moral currency. It's become a legitimacy scoring. It decides who gets to speak and who stays silent. And when identity is kind of turned into oppression Olympics like that, there's like no room for context. There's no room for solidarity or collective power. There's no room for collaboration. There's just none of that when oppression Olympics is prioritized. And, you know, the internet, I think, that especially the algorithm, it relies on the fact that things are simple to keep running. You know, like platforms aren't built for truth, they're built for attention. And when you really realize that, you can just see how we're just hooked in. And there's like that attention. And the way that our systems exist as well, and the way that they remain the status quo, is that they need that simplicity to function. And so, you know, the internet needs to flatten us to keep running, but that's not what humanity is. We are not built to be flattened, and identity is so complex and ever-changing and a forever thing. So, you know, I'm not saying that I have all of the answers in the world. This is something that is so complex. But I think the key questions that we do need to ask ourselves is like, how do we honor identity without being trapped in it? How do we stay principled without becoming rigid? And how do we hold moral clarity and emotional nuance? And I think those questions really help us or guide us in moving through the complexity that is the world. Because you know how earlier I was saying, like, you know, that little disclaimer of like, of course there is a line and there are some things where it really is not that complicated. This is not rights. But then there are some things where we really do need to invite that complexity and that nuance to get to a place where there's more understanding of each other. Because, you know, there's so much difference in our world, the way, and we all need to like learn how to live with each other, and we need to live in a world where our systems do not silence or marginalize anyone. And I think those questions, you know, they're not the answers or the solutions, but I think these questions really capture that, like, the complexity of it all. Especially that, like, how do we hold moral clarity and emotional nuance? And how do we stay principled without becoming rigid? And I think a key thing to understand here is that, like, identity is relational. Judith Butler makes a really good argument that identity is not a thing that we possess. It's a thing that we perform in relation to others. So what the heck does that mean? Identity changes depending on who we're with, the context, our safety, our community, our sense of belonging. So, you know, changing isn't hypocrisy at all, though, you know, the system and the internet would like to tell us that it is. But it's adaptation, it's survival, and it's growth. And it's always been that way. So yeah, identity is very much a relational thing. And I think another really important thing to consider is that identity, it should be a doorway, not a prison. And I think identity is a really beautiful starting point to, you know, invite us to question the stories that we tell ourselves when we're moving through this world, the map that guides us in this life. It is a good starting point when we're thinking about the lens in which we view this world, the filters in which we process information and our systems, and the way that we relate to other people. And identity is a really wonderful starting point for that. So when you think about it like that, identity is not a destination. Like, we should allow identity to be the lens in which we enter through, and it's the anchor and the grounding, but it's also not the limit. It's not the script. It's not the cage, and it's not the algorithm. And it's not something that is experienced in isolation. You know, when identity, you know, it is relational. So that, you know, relation really relies on community. And community is everything. It's something that we hear a lot, like the power of the collective. And, you know, we know that part of that cost of having community is inconvenience. And I think why that cost of community is worth it is, you know, sometimes healthy community means being misunderstood. Healthy community looks like apologizing. Healthy community is sitting in that tension. Healthy community is being corrected gently. Healthy community looks like staying when it's awkward. Healthy community means, you know, adjusting when it's needed. And healthy community is choosing repair over cancellation. And so, you know, identity performance, which is what the internet prioritizes, it builds audiences, but identity honesty, and that starts with being honest with yourself and the people around you, it builds community. And we need more community, not necessarily audience. Not that there's anything wrong with being part of an audience or building audiences. And no, being part of an audience is, you know, being part of digital home places, but we need community. And being honest about our identity with ourselves and with people around us, it builds that community. And community holds space for that complexity. Because healthy community, when you're staying when it's awkward and choosing that repair and sitting in that tension, like, that's where the growth comes through. That is where the nuance comes through. And I think if we did more of that, the solutions and how to live with each other despite our differences will come about, and the solutions to our systems will come about as well. And so I think it's really important that we choose that honesty around our identity. And I think resisting that algorithmic flattening is so important, because the algorithm wants that consistency and that predictability, the branding, the loyalty, and the identity performance. But I think resisting that, it can come in many forms, but, you know, it could look like surprising people. It could look like evolving publicly. It could be, you know, sharing things which are you know, air tags around this off-brand, having days where you don't post, and just, you know, overall refusing to be a mascot for your identity and allowing space for that honesty and the ever-evolving nature of our identities. I think essentially what I'm trying to say is that, you know, you are not an aesthetic for other people to consume. So resist that algorithmic flattening and refuse to become an aesthetic. And I know that, you know, the internet is complicated because it opens so many doors, right? And it's so accessible. And, you know, there's good that comes from the internet. You know, the things that I've learned, the communities that I've been exposed to, the hot takes and tips and tricks, like, they've all been amazing. But I think we have to keep mindfully consuming it and mindfully keep using it in a way where our humanity is still ours, whether it's in real life or online. And I think it's really easy for that humanity to be lost online. It's really easy to become an aesthetic as opposed to just being you online, right? And so I think I really want to, like, bring it home that you are not an aesthetic for other people to consume. And when we embrace that our humanity and the complexity of it, we're able to build that community. And whether that community is, like, in real life or it's the online community, I think when that's prioritized, there is room to build a shared purpose. And I think that shared purpose should really be the fuel for our solidarity. I think when our identities can become packaged into aesthetics, then there's, like, this sense of solidarity that is now built on sameness. And I think a really good way of thinking about it is Arundhati Roy. They had a vision of a world where many worlds fit. And I think that is a beautiful antidote to the friction that is ever increasing in our world. You know, I'm just, like, dreaming of a world where many worlds fit. And when you think about it like that, it's not saying that we all have to be the same, or we all have to package ourselves into one world. We are living in a world where many worlds fit. And you see this, like, you know, a world where many worlds fit. You see little slivers of it. So, you know, whether it's online or in real life. And I think that's so beautiful. Like, when you think about, you know, indigenous climate movements uniting across the world, when you think about cross-ethnic feminist coalitions coming together, when you think about the solidarity among marginalized groups, like, I'm thinking of Tangata Whenua and Palestine. And so when you think about it like that, like, solidarity is not sameness, it is shared purpose. And a world where many worlds fit is a world where humanity, our full humanness is prioritized, and identity is not flattened into this simple thing, into a script. And I think that solidarity across difference is really important. Yeah. I love it when you stumble across, like, words that just really describe how you think about things. And I think a world where many worlds fit is just one of those things. And, you know, I know that this is really hard to navigate, but I think we also need to make space for being wrong and to allow that repair. You know, it just, especially in cancel culture, being wrong feels like a death sentence, right? But being wrong is to be human. And, you know, being committed to moving in this world ethically means, you know, it means to make a mistake. And, you know, there are moments where people thrive when people can ask or change, reflect, get it wrong, and come back, apologize, and grow. And I think cancel culture, there is that sense of accountability, right? But I think sometimes cancel culture, there isn't any repair. And I feel like accountability without repair is just straight up punishment. And, you know, sometimes that punishment is warranted. Like, again, with that, like, there's a line and there are some things that are just not complicated. But with the complexity of it all, accountability without repair is just punishment. And punishment doesn't lead to growth. And I think also another thing that I want to talk about when it comes to, like, being wrong and this, like, simplified world that we're living in is sometimes I've noticed this, especially with the, like, response to Lily Allen's new album, is that now there's this idea of, like, the perfect victim. You know, this album where Lily Allen is talking about how her ex-husband really did her wrong, really did her dirty. And she's speaking honestly about that experience. And, you know, people saying, well, you know, boycott the album, or, like, what, she cannot be a victim because she did XYZ to other people. And I think we can only understand this if you are the perfect victim. And again, I'm not here to invalidate what Lily Allen has done to other people, but I'm also not here to invalidate what was done to her. And I think the idea or the moral standard of, like, the perfect victim, it just doesn't exist. Sometimes, like, it's complicated. And so I think we do need to make space for being wrong and make space for that repair as well. And I think another key thing that we need to hold on to is, like, holding that moral clarity and the emotional complexity. And I think this, like, you know, if we're walking along a tightrope, like, the tightrope clearly doesn't exist for this online. I think it's the nuance that the internet really struggles with, because I think some issues are not morally complicated, like genocide and ethnic cleansing and state violence and apartheid and oppression. But people are emotionally complex when it comes to how they learn, how they grieve, how they radicalize, how they disconnect, how they build courage, how they unlearn harmful ideas. And, you know, both of those things can be true at the same time. And that's why knowing your identity, I think, is so important, because people are emotionally complex. Like, there are some things that are just not morally complicated, but people are emotionally complex with how they, you know, unpack how they even look at this world and how they move through this world. And it is emotionally complex how you learn and grieve and disconnect and build courage. And so I think we can hold space for clear ethics and soft humanity at the same time, but the internet makes us feel like we cannot do that. But I'm telling you, we can, y'all. And part of holding clear ethics and soft humanity is how we refuse identity as an aesthetic, and having our identity, which is something that is full of mountains and valleys and peaks and troughs, and not be flattened into something that is 2D. And knowing our identity and allowing our identity to be experienced and perceived in its fullness, whether it's in person or online, I think is a really clear pathway to holding clear ethics and soft humanity at the same time. And so, you know, what I want to say is that identity is a lens and it's not the whole camera. And it's so important in, you know, in 2026 that we honor identity, we reject identity essentialism, we embrace the contradiction, we choose the complexity, we resist binary thinking, we build across differences, we root ourselves in moral clarity, we make space for growth, and we stop letting algorithms define our humanity. And it's so important that we do that, because with this increasing like friction and tension, you know, I think the world is going to tell us through our identities, like, this is how we reduce the friction, this is, you know, how we put out the metaphorical fire, and that's not true. We need, like, I feel like if we want to get to a place where we are living in a world where many worlds fit, we need to hold clear ethics and soft humanity at the same time. We need to be asking ourselves, you know, how do we honor identity without being trapped in it? How do we stay principled without becoming rigid? How do we hold moral clarity and emotional nuance? We need to be asking ourselves those questions if we want to be living in a world where many worlds fit. And I think it's so important that we try to find that world as soon as possible, because, you know, the friction is getting a lot. The heat is getting hotter. There's so much happening, and we need to find that world stat. So, yes, identity matters deeply, and I hope that, you know, this year and for all of the years to come, that is something that you keep prioritizing for yourself, and it's something that you keep on exploring, because it is ever evolving, and having that identity and knowing your identity is so important. It is a foundation. But please remember, when we live in a world where our humanity is, you know, our humanity, so therefore our identity is something that our world is pushing us to simplify, that, you know, our identity is not the full story, and we are more than our labels. And I think, you know, the most radical thing we can do in a world trying to flatten us is to push for and insist on our fullness. You know, we contain multitudes and layers, okay? And the multitudes very much matter. Thank you for tuning into another episode of Headscarves and Good Yarns. And may we have an amazing 2026 ahead of us. Thanks, y'all, for tuning in.
Thank you for tuning in into another episode of Headscarves and Good Yarns. To keep spinning the yarns, let us know your thoughts. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Headscarves and Good Yarns, or email us at headscarvesandgoodyarn@gmail.com.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.